Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We seem to have visitors from a school here. Does somebody want to tell the court who these school children are?
Yes, the students here are from Rolling Hills Elementary, which is part of the Montego Area School District. They're on the end of our tour. We'll be leaving in the next 20 minutes, but we wanted to see the students.
Well, we're delighted. Why don't all the students please stand up so the court can see them clearly?
These are fourth grade students.
Well, we're delighted to have you all with us to listen to this case. If you want to have a summary of this case, they're outside. You might want to take them with you if you like. Oh, they're here. You may be seated. I would like to introduce the court to all of you, if I might. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rodensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. Now, a question that's often asked is, why do all these nameplates start with J? What's the answer? Well, there are seven justices, and they all stand for J. And CJ, Chief Justice. This is always a great curiosity.
I thought they all stood for John in the beginning.
John, you catch on fast.
Right.
A couple of years, right. All right. We now turn to 02-2817, James Cape and Sons versus Mulcahy et al. Arguing on behalf of the attorney of the state is Charlotte Gibson, and this is the second time this court has heard argument in this case. Counsel?
Good afternoon. Before I start my argument, I just wanted to let the court know about another proceeding that theoretically could bear on this case, which is that about 2 weeks ago, Cape went into a Chapter 128 receivership in Racine County. And I was concerned that the first-day injunction that's typically ordered in those cases could enjoin this proceeding as well from going forward. So the attorney from my office who's representing the state's claims in that case, and I talked to the receiver this morning, Mike Polsky, and told him about it. Apparently it was the first he had heard that there was a Supreme Court case involving Cape pending. And what he suggested is that this court should go ahead and determine what liability Cape has to the state, and that in the event that Cape does have liability, that what we'll do is file a claim in the Chapter 128 proceeding.
Did the stay indeed issue?
Well, the stay was a very general stay that just says all proceedings seeking to collect from the debtor or Cape are enjoined except insofar as they are attempting to liquidate liability under this proceeding, from which I read to be this 128 proceeding. So that was, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, when you say 128, I'm familiar with the Chapter 10, Chapter 11, Chapter 7. What bankruptcy, what are they in?
State. These are state bankruptcy proceeding.
All right.
But borrowing, we often borrow from the federal bankruptcy code when we do 128 because the case law is so sparse. And this would be a pretty standard procedure in a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 11, too. So,
just for clarification, then, I understand you to be saying that there is no stay that was issued that would preclude or in any way affect this proceeding today from going forward. Is that correct?
or to the extent there was any ambiguity about it, the receiver who's in charge of the case said that they're going to have an order specifically exempting this case.
Okay. That was my concern, because I heard you essentially say, well, I talked to the receiver and he said it's going to be okay, but it's not okay if there's a – it's not necessarily okay if there is a court order in any way affecting this. I mean, it –
Right, that's
not
what
automatically
I,
okay.
I mean, right, I mean, that's what I was concerned about. So I just wanted to clarify with him, and I didn't know if it was something that had sort of run through any of your mind, so I just thought we'd get that out of the way.
What's the status of the bond at issue here at this point? Is the bond, has it ever been collected upon, or is it sitting someplace?
Well, my understanding of the case is that originally in the circuit court, the bonding company was trying to intervene, and Judge Krieger did grant that intervention motion. So the bonding company was going to be an active party. But then all the parties stipulated to put the forfeiture money into circuit court, and then they released the bonding company. And at the time they entered that stipulation and order, the contemplation was that the $100,000 was going to stay there until all appeals were exhausted, which is what the order and stipulation says. But at some point, they must have changed their minds about it, because when Kate prevailed on its motion for summary judgment in the circuit court, the money was released back to Kate then. So I think the bonding company is not an available party anymore because of that stipulation and order. I think the 128 proceeding would be our sole remedy at this point.
So the $100,000 is in Kate's hands.
Right.
Although if the state wants to get it, they're going to be as part of the receivership.
Right.
They'll just have to stand in line with everybody else or whatever the rights are. Okay.
Right.
And the underlying project, which was the basis of this suit, is long since completed and everyone has folded up their tents and gone home?
I don't know if the work is totally finished. I've assumed that it was because it's been so long. But my understanding that CAPE's part of that project was finished because CAPE did do that project.
They had the paving contract, as I understand.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'll move on to my argument. And since it's been a year since we were last together discussing the case, I want to begin by briefly outlining what the department seeks from the court today. We ask the court to reaffirm the standard in Nelson that reasonable care applies when a public contracting bidder seeks to withdraw its bid without forfeiting its guarantee after the bids have been opened. Second, we ask the court to clarify that the state's bidding statutes do not permit the bidder to amend its bid and continue in the bidding process. And third, we ask the court to hold that CAPE has not met its burden to show that its bid mistake was free from carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect.
This was a summary judgment.
That's right.
You'd say that's a trial issue. Trial issue was whether there was a mistake, error, or omission.
No, there was. They conceded that there was a mistake.
Free from carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect would be, in your opinion, a trial issue.
Well, the parties filed cross motions for summary judgment, and at that point, CAPE was required to come forward with some evidence showing that it met a standard of reasonable care. And I don't believe that happened here.
All right.
Let me ask, was there not evidence put on at the hearing before Judge Krieger?
I think the problem was that the evidence presented didn't establish reasonable care. Just as an example, one thing Kate focused on was how quickly they had notified the state of the error. Well, that doesn't go to negligence. They also told the court, well, it was just a clerical error. And as we discussed last year, that again doesn't go to negligence. What Kate failed to show was that it followed a standard procedure of looking for errors in the bids, making that check against the worksheets, and not finding the error anyway. Instead, there's no evidence that they performed the check against the worksheet at all.
Counselor, as I look at the statute, I've been thinking of it this way, and I want you to tell me where you think I'm off the track. There seem to me to be three scenarios within the statute. The first one is when there is error that's discovered before the bids are open. So we're not there at all, so we can discard that. The other two involve errors that are discovered after the bids are open. In the second scenario, there's a requirement that there be written notice and that there be, how does the statute say it, clear and satisfactory evidence that this error was not caused by any careless act or omission in examining the plans and specifications. Okay, I see that as kind of a something that CAPE has the obligation to show. And then the third part of the statute says if there's a forfeiture that is present, and under our case law you only get there if the city decides to or the municipality decides to award the contract, correct? Then you can only get your money back if you can show that the mistake was, quote, free from carelessness, negligence, or inexcusable neglect. And in my mind, I'm seeing the first test I set out for you as one where if CAPE meets that burden, then there isn't a forfeiture available. And in fact, they've met the burden, and that's what the statute is all about, and you can argue that the municipality could have the discretion to let them go forward, or you could say there's no discretion. That's just the end of it. They get out of any forfeiture of the bid bond the same way the first person did, whose error was discovered before the opening of the bids. Now, why am I wrong about having two separate standards for someone who shows an error after the bids are opened?
Well, you're going wrong when you create three standards rather than two. And I just want to remind you again that those four sentences make it look attractive to do that. But if you go back to what the statute looked like before the recodification, it won't be as tempting at all to you. You have the pre-opening standard, and you're right. Before the bids are open, we're not in that scenario, and that's one half of the statute. The other half of the statute is about after the bids are opened. And the problem is you can't transform the third sentence from an obligation of CAPE to reassure, or of the bidder generally, to reassure the public authority that it's a qualified bidder on the project. And this is akin to an UCC or contracts law where when we have doubts that a party is going to perform a contract, we're entitled to seek reasonable assurances that they'll perform. They're showing us again that they're qualified in all ways. One thing that the third sentence requires is that they comply with the entirety of 660901, which requires that they have the financial ability to do the work. Now, if all we were doing was laying them out of the contract, we wouldn't care about whether they had the financial ability to do the work.
But that's part of the second scenario, as I see it, because they have to show that there wasn't any carelessness in examining the plans or specifications and conforming with the statute. So to me, that's all part of what they have to show, and if they have to show that and do, why aren't they finished? Why does the municipality get to keep their money if they choose to award the contract?
Because they're not showing that as a function of trying to withdraw from the bidding. They're showing that in order to keep going in the bidding, because the fact that they've made material mistakes in their bid sheds doubt on the conclusion that they're qualified to be in this bid.
But that doesn't make sense to me when you say that part of it is to let them keep going, because the forfeiture part of it on the other side is clearly when they don't want to keep going.
Right.
So you're saying that they can correct it then? Is that what you said?
No, if they establish that they're still qualified, they stay in the bidding, and then they're a qualified bidder entitled to keep going. They have to make the notification regardless of whether they want out or not.
Why is that fair to the person who tells the municipality, hey, there's a mistake before the bids are ever open, and that person can't bid on the project at all unless it's relet? Doesn't seem fair.
Because of the critical informational moment that constitutes the opening of the bids. That's when the option contract is created, is when those bids are open and we no longer have confidence that the process is clean.
Right, but if you discovered a bid, error in your bid one day before, you correct it and you send it back in, you can't do that. Well, but yet you're saying that someone whose error might be similar and is discovered after the bids are open can keep going. It seems unfair to the person that acknowledged there was an error before the bids were ever opened, doesn't it?
But the problem is the bidding statutes are for the protection of the public, and bid opening creates a lot of dangerous issues for the public because now all the bidders can look around the table and see how everybody else bid. The process is fundamentally transformed by that moment, and so the way we can give relief to a bidder has to change. We can't just say anymore, oh, you made a mistake, you can just go home easily now.
Isn't...
I don't understand.
Isn't that, this subsection 5 intended to codify the equitable rescission doctrine?
That's right. With modifications, Nelson says.
Okay. But the equitable rescission doctrine isn't just to protect the public.
No, it's to balance the needs of the public with the needs of the bidder. And one thing I want to say about how equitable rescission has been applied among courts that didn't have a statute and were just making up a common law rule is only about half of them have gone with a good faith or culpable negligence, something basically akin to what CAPE is trying to get in one form or another here from the court. And the other half of the jurisdictions have gone with either reasonable care or no relief at all. So equitable rescission does not equal just show us that you were made a mistake in good faith and you're done.
What does it mean?
Well, what are your duties? When the information starts to come in under the third sentence of the subsection, what are the duties of the municipality, which in this case is the state?
Well, I think that in general, when there is a mistake in a bid, the municipality needs to reassure itself that bidders who are making notifications of mistake are qualified to continue in the bid. And then if you're asking specifically, well, what if somebody comes up and says, you know, I've made such a big mistake and I really would like to withdraw from the process, then I think at that time the municipality should consider whether it thinks they meet the reasonable care standard, whether the mistake occurred despite the exercise of reasonable care. And if the municipality thinks that they did, they should just settle the case and say, okay, you can withdraw without forfeiture.
Okay. Is it just solely the discretion of the municipality whether they decide whether or not to let them off the hook?
Well, I don't like using the word discretion because that implies that if they say, no, we don't think your mistake happened despite reasonable care, and make them forfeit the bid bond if they don't agree to remain in the bidding process, that then when it goes to circuit court, that the discretionary decision would be given some kind of deference. I see the fourth sentence of the statute as creating an original action with no deference, and that's something that reviews what the agency did. So
let's say that I submit a bid, and I'm the low bidder. Don't you have the authority to say, we don't think you're a responsible bidder, and we're not going to award this to you?
That's right.
All right. Now, what is the standard of review for that?
That, if the bidder said, no, I want to stay in, I am responsible, the standard of review for that would be whether the agency's decision was unreasonable. So it would be very deferential to the agency.
Would that be a certiorari standard of review?
Well, certiorari is not available, but they could seek a declaratory judgment.
Why do you say the certiorari is not available?
I believe that's what the court said in Hron. I'm probably mispronouncing it, H-R-O-N.
Okay.
What would be the record for a certiorari review? Don't you have to have a record? Does the agency make a record if it says, well, I'm not taking your bid because although it's low, we don't think you really can fulfill the contract?
Well, again, it's not certiorari review. It's a declaratory judgment action, so you're not really starting with a record. You're starting with an original action. But you're right. Presumably there would be some kind of determination letter where the municipality wrote to the bidder and said, for the following five reasons, we've determined you're not a qualified bidder on this contract.
But no hearing before the agency.
This goes well beyond this case because we're talking about how do agencies make determinations about who's a qualified bidder. That's something that they're required... That's something that the municipality is required to do in general before they start. The bidding, in both of our bid statutes, I believe that there are requirements that there be kind of a pre-qualification analysis, but I don't think there's ever been a rule that you get a hearing on that.
Okay.
And I had to think about under 227, there's some probably analogous situations about licenses that might be similar.
Counsel, I want to focus at the beginning of your presentation. You indicated three things you would like from this court, and the second of the three was to clarify that the state statute does not permit CAPE to amend. When I was reading your brief, and you talked about the Nelson case and discussed the right to amend and the right to withdraw vis-a-vis the Nelson case, and with regard to amendment, I understood your brief to indicate that there was no amendment as of right, but based on Nelson, I'm looking at pages 6 and 9 of your brief, that the municipality could allow amendment, but there was no amendment as of right. Am I reading too much into your brief, or is that what you're
asking? Are you reading my first brief or my second brief?
The second brief. Let me help you out. Page 6 of your second brief says, quoting from Nelson, it says, "It's clear from the statute that amendment is not a matter of right. A bidder has no absolute right to withdraw or amend a bid for a public contract, and the governmental body could not be compelled to allow an amendment. Where the governmental body has refused to allow an amendment," you know, which means sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, "where the governmental body has refused to allow an amendment and has chosen instead, et cetera," you quote that, and then you pick that up with on page 9, in the middle of page 9, saying, "A public authority has no legal obligation, however, to permit correction or release a bidder." You just finished the Nelson discussion earlier, talking about, you know, you can do it as a matter of settlement, just like you responded to.
Right, and I hope I can read this clearly in the brief, that DOT thinks that correction is not a permissible remedy under the statute, and that's why they told CAPE, "We don't allow you to correct, but you can withdraw." The Nelson language that says correction is not an enforceable right, but it's something the agency could do, all comes again from the reviser's title. And I can't find any support anywhere for a correction remedy that doesn't trace back to that reviser's title. And I think it was just added rather quickly without a lot of thought. It wasn't part of the act. And for the reasons in the brief, I think correction is not.
Okay, so that's, I think I misunderstood that. So it's your position that not only is it not an available remedy for CAPE, it certainly is not an available remedy as a matter of right, it's not available, but in addition to that, the municipality cannot authorize amendment. And the municipality has no authority to authorize amendment.
Right.
That seems a little bit different than what Nelson said that you're quoting.
It is. And I think what's important about the language in Nelson is obviously it's not a holding. This court didn't grant a remedy of correction. The bidder didn't go home and do this contract on different terms. So it's dicta, and I don't think we can presume legislative acquiescence in it given that it's just dicta. But I do think that nobody really went back and thought about that title carefully, and it just has kind of infused the case law a little bit without ever being a holding. I like to see a correspondence between rights and remedies. It struck me as odd the first time I read Nelson that we have a right to withdraw without forfeiture and that remedy in the statute, but then maybe there's correction, but you don't have any way to enforce that. So there's a kind of odd asymmetry to it.
That's not what Nelson says, though. Is it as I understand Nelson, Nelson is basically saying that the municipality has an option. And I'm trying to read Nelson in the context of the third sentence now of the statute. Because when you read the third sentence of the statute, Nelson kind of makes sense from the standpoint that if you're going to allow, in fact, require a bidder to correct any errors, omissions, or mistakes upon discovery, the statute doesn't say what happens next. But Nelson seems to infer from that, unless I'm misreading it, that there's got to be something, otherwise the statute doesn't make any sense. So the statute's saying, here, you've got this ground here. We want you to submit the correction. Now you submit the correction. The municipality ostensibly could take the option of saying, okay, we agree, this makes sense, we'll allow the correction. Or the municipality can say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to accept the bid as is and then send you down the forfeiture path. Doesn't the municipality have that option?
I don't think they do, because I don't think correction is a permitted remedy under the statute. And again, going back to Justice Rosenstein's question, I see the third sentence, or what used to be the first clause in the second sentence, as being about providing reassurances to the municipality that despite its material error, the bidder remains qualified to bid on the project. I don't see it purely as something you do when you're seeking to correct or withdraw your bid.
But, Counselor, if that's what it is, and they provide that, those assurances, the only way you're ever going to get to rescission is if the contract is awarded and the contractor doesn't want to perform. It's not economically feasible contractor for the contract. Otherwise, if you award the contractor will perform. So you never get to forfeiture. You never really have rescission, which means to put everybody back where they started from.
Well, another scenario that could happen is the bidder could just say, upon discovery of the mistake, say, I am not willing to perform this contract, and if you award it to me, I will not perform. And depending on the language of the bid bond, right then a forfeiture could be imposed. Right. Forfeiture results from the breach of the option contract, the agreement to stay in the bidding process. It's not a function of the award of the contract.
I thought we had case law that says you have to award the contract in order to forfeiture to come in. I don't think it just operates from the statute.
No, if you look at, and you're talking about Gastra, and if you look at Gastra carefully, what happened there was Gastra never withdrew or indicated he was not willing to perform, and then they went ahead and awarded the contract to somebody else. As long as the bidder says, yes, I'm willing, I'm standing by my agreement to stay in this process, if the project is awarded to someone else, the bid bond cannot be held forfeited. And that's what happened in Gastra.
And that's what I'm saying is you can't, I mean, if what you're saying is true, it would have to follow that you could award the contract to someone else and still forfeit the money, and that can never be. You have to award the contract to the contractor. That's when you get a forfeiture, is for the ultimate failure to perform. If it were not that case, well, the statute doesn't make any sense, because why would you ever be able to forfeit someone's bid bond who said they had a mistake if they were still willing to perform the contract? Why would those...
You shouldn't. To the extent the party remains willing to perform the contract, a bid bond should not be forfeited.
Or was the party here willing to perform the contract?
No.
It was not.
So it was not. Therefore, whether the contract was awarded to that party or not is irrelevant from your standpoint.
Exactly.
I don't think so.
Because there was a breach as soon as you pulled out. As soon as you pulled out. That's your position.
But they did award the contract. They did award the contract here, correct? Or am I wrong?
Yes, they did.
All right. And the reason that they awarded the contract is to complete the circle. I mean, if they didn't award it to Cape and they awarded it to Sam Smith's company, I don't think they would have kept the bid bond.
Well, in this particular case, and I said this in the brief too, some bid bonds limit the imposition of forfeiture to cases where the party actually turns out to be the low bidder and is awarded the contract. I think otherwise you have kind of a no harm, no foul rule, that if I withdraw even though I breached, if my bid was way up here...
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Right. So what is the language of this bond?
This bid bond said... my copy may be too black.
Did it say you have to be awarded the contract before you forfeit?
Oh, here it is. If the principal is awarded the contract and within the time and manner required by law after the prescribed forms are presented, enters into a written contract, then the bond goes away. So in this particular case, they followed the no harm, no foul rule. But there are other cases cited in my brief where there was a clear withdrawal by the party before the contract was awarded and the bid bond was forfeited because of that withdrawal. It's the option contract that forms the basis for the bid bond forfeiture. That happens before the award of contract.
What you were just reading from, is that referenced in the material?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have given you a record site. That, I'm reading from Exhibit 2 from David Schuster's deposition, I think, of June 3rd, 2002. But we can't make a rule of law that applies generally based on any one bid bond because some of them have language like this, some of them have much different language. And I see that my red...
It seems to me you could make a rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
You could make a rule of law that there ought to be a little bit more generous waiver where this has not been stipulated. If it's been stipulated in writing, it seems to me there should be less ability to get out of things.
I guess I'm not getting your comment.
It seems to me that those letting the bid can establish the conditions under which there's going to be a forfeiture and make put that in writing. If they don't do that, it seems to me the pure terms of the statute are going to apply.
But the bidder is not entitled to withdraw its bid, and so the agency is entitled to award the contract.
That's your interpretation of the statute. It seems to me what the statute does is codify equitable rescission. And equitable rescission basically is that when there has been a mistake by one party as opposed to mutual mistake, there has to be, at least if you can show reasonable grounds, a basis to withdraw and not be penalized.
Right, but the question is, what is the basis to rescind?
Well, and obviously the court is going to decide that, and the court did decide that in this case.
Well, my red light's on, so.
You may answer the question if you think it's a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't read it as a question. Did you think it was a question, Justice Breyer?
This court, but
I don't answer
court
the questions here.
Your position is they shouldn't have decided it because it's a fact issue, not summary judgment.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Mr. Sindebrand, representing Cape Company.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Carl Sindebrand. From Wickwire Gavin here in Madison, and I represent the plaintiff respondent, James Cape and Sons Company. I am here prepared to discuss the three kind of general sets of questions that you had presented to us, but I would like to make a couple preliminary points based on the dialogue that's been taking place so far today. First of all, I agree with Justice Rogensack. I think that the statute, while it is a mess in many ways, is clear that it contemplates three temporal scenarios: before the bids are opened, after the bids are opened but before there is an award, which could trigger a forfeiture, and after an award has occurred, and therefore there can be a forfeiture.
Mr. Sindebrand, for that second temporal point, the middle one, and I borrow from one of my fellow justices in trying to make boxes. I don't do them as well as he does. But one of the problems that I'm having is that while the statute seems to recognize this area where you got the bid having been opened, but the contract's not, the bid has not been awarded, it doesn't say what happens next. What are we supposed to do with it?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the question comes, how do we give this section that's two sentences in the middle of the statute meaning? Because we have to give it independent meaning. If it is just a notification that has no substantive import or even procedural import, we can't adopt an interpretation on that basis. Our view is that it is a standard for granting relief. Throughout this proceeding in the circuit court and in the court of appeals to the bidder, this whole section, 66.0901, subsection 5, I should say this whole subsection, focuses on relief to to the bidders. That is the really only purpose of this subsection, and I believe that the statutory title is very accurate, and I will get to that.
And I don't mean to cut you off, but
sure.
If the whole section is only related to the bidder, the fourth sentence of sub 5 allows for the bond to be kept by the municipality. So it's not just the bidder. There's relief that goes both ways here.
I don't read it that way, Your Honor. Justice Butler, I would say the fourth sentence is the provision that relates to how a bidder can recover a forfeited bid security if there has been a forfeiture. It is not the section which affirmatively allows the municipality to keep the forfeiture. It only says, if a forfeiture has occurred, here's your procedure for getting it back.
Yeah, well, it says, unless it is proven before a court of competent jurisdiction in an action brought for recovery, forfeited and making the mistake, error, or omission, the bidder is free from carelessness, negligence, or excusable neglect. So,
correct.
That's the last part of that sentence.
Exactly. And so under those circumstances where the forfeiture has already occurred, then that is the bidder's remedy for recovery of the forfeited security. The second sentence, then, the only independent meaning we can ascribe to it, is that it is an independent opportunity for relief that occurs post-opening but pre-award. And throughout this proceeding, really up until maybe the reply brief for today, the state has been unable to articulate an independent meaning for that second and third sentence. Today they say, well, it is to reassure the municipality that the bidder remains qualified. But there is no need to reassure the municipality if the bidder is just going to accept the bid with its error. I mean, they say we've got an error in the bidder, and the municipality says, fine, you're still the low bidder, you're awarded. There'd be no reason for the legislature to impose this standard of proof. And this is the same three-part analysis that the court adopted in Turtle Lake versus Overdahl. So it is not new to this particular case that we ascribe this meaning to the statute that has three independent parts.
Senator Brand, can you help me out here? Because I don't know where to look. Where is the provision that authorizes the municipality to collect the forfeiture? If you know. If you don't, we'll look it up.
It's in 660901, and I'm looking to find it, and it may be in 8 or 9, but I would have to scrutinize
I'll check to confirm. Thank you.
A couple of other points I would like to make before getting to this correction question, which is, I think, one of the reasons we're here today.
What the Court of
said is the following, and it is slightly different facts, but their holding is unequivocal. We hold that acceptance of the bid is a prerequisite to forfeiture. The way a municipality accepts the bid is they award the contract. And so it is quite clear under that case, I don't know how you could interpret it, that sentence, any other way. Another point that I'd like to make is that counsel for DOT keeps referring to the common law equitable remedy as being rescission. And therefore, there is no right to or opportunity to correct. Well, that's not exactly correct. If we look at the Nelson case, and I believe it's on page 409, the Nelson case cites as authority a New Jersey court that held, quote, in the absence of equities justifying rescission or other equitable relief, a successful bidder cannot arbitrarily withdraw his bid at any time before acceptance. So the common law relief, and later on Nelson says on the same page, courts have granted relief in equity to a bidder who, having discovered a material mistake of fact in his bid, which is not due to his own failure to exercise ordinary care, acts promptly in informing the public authorities and requests the withdrawal or correction of his bid before the award is made. The equitable rule that underlies this statute is accurately articulated in Nelson, and that is authority. It is not the title of the statute that allows municipalities to correct or allow withdrawal of bids. It is the common law rule that is the precedent that was codified as part of this statute that allowed either withdrawal or correction. In that regard, I would like to make very clear to the Court, from our perspective, that there is a difference between a right to a relief and a right to a particular form of remedy. The Nelson case refers to the common law as saying there is no right to amend, no absolute right to amend. And the cases that it relies on for those, the Menzel case, the Huron case, the Aquatech case, all stand for the proposition that you cannot get mandamus to force the agency or the municipality to award a contract in a particular way, because the municipality always has the option to reject all bids. And so when we talk about what this statute provides, our view is that it provides a right to relief, but there is discretion abiding within the municipality as to the form of relief. In some circumstances, withdrawal may be appropriate. In other circumstances, correction may be appropriate. Surely if there's no issue about fraud or other bidders complaining, legitimately complaining, and correction of a bid will result in the bidder remaining the low bid, it is in the public interest to allow that municipality to direct correction of the bid.
Counsel? When exercising the discretion to allow withdrawal, or as you posit, the amendment, do you believe that the municipalities are acting in a quasi-judicial capacity?
I do believe that, Your Honor. I believe that, and there are standards that apply that guide their conduct, and on review, as we've set forth in our brief, and as stated in the Aquatech case, where there was a kind of an injunction declaratory judgment action, the standard for review is going to be abuse of discretion, unreasonable conduct, arbitrary and capricious, the kinds of standards that we historically apply to quasi-judicial activities. So I do believe that it is a quasi-judicial activity.
Counsel, in your brief on page supplemented. I guess 21, maybe.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you
21.
Said. 21.
I thought someplace in that area you said you agreed with the state that the review, there was independent review in the circuit court, and that it was de novo.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is that consistent or inconsistent with what you're saying?
There is inconsistent. I understand your question, Your Honor. Under the fourth test, under the fourth sentence, which is the third seat scenario, plainly this is an original action in the circuit court, which is going to independently review the character of the evidence. In the middle section, or the middle grounds for relief, the form of the action that will occur, as has occurred in a numerous other case, the Dremel case, the Aquatech case, a conventional civil action seeking declaratory relief, seeking temporary and permanent injunction as in Aquatech. Under those circumstances, I don't think that the trial court is going to independently review the character of the evidence, but whether the agency or the municipality was engaged in unreasonable conduct, abused its discretion, was arbitrary and capricious, those kinds of standards. So if my brief suggests otherwise, I hope that clarifies.
I need to push you just a little bit further. And that is, I still hear, and I think I must not be hearing correctly, I still hear you saying de novo review in your brief and saying it now, and yet there's a component of erroneous exercise of discretion. As though there's two standards. Am I missing something?
I don't think you're missing something, but maybe I can clarify. Under the middle test, if you will, the post-opening pre-award scenario, it's not a Chapter 227 review. It is a civil action. But
like this, a declaratory judgment.
Yes,
like,
exactly. Yeah. But the and if there, as in this action, there was a legal error, DOT said, we don't have any authority to grant relief. We can't correct, and if you withdraw, you forfeit, period. So for that, that's a question of law for which there would be de novo review. And you know, whether there's any deference given is a whole separate issue to the legal interpretation. But in terms of whether the bidder had met its standard of proof showing that it was free from carelessness in examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the statute, presumably the municipality is going to make a decision, and that's what's going to trigger the action. And the circuit court would be reviewing the agency's or municipality's decision under that abuse of discretion, unreasonable conduct, arbitrary and capricious type standard. As in the Aquatech case, I think that is a reasonable guidepost.
On the correction of the bid, I'm just unable to understand why, if an error is found before the bid is opened, and the bidder says, may I have this back, why the bidder could not correct it and resubmit it before the timeline ran out and before anything was opened. And yet you say, but afterwards, we can correct the bid. It's too inconsistent for me.
I think based on equitable principles, you're right that there's no reason. If it's pre-opening, why shouldn't the bidder be allowed to correct and resubmit it? And the only answer I can give you, Justice Brasser, is that because that's what the legislature said. And the statute is quite clear.
Where does it say that?
The first sentence, actually it's the second sentence. This is the pre-opening. If the bidder makes this fact, the fact of error known, the bid shall be returned to the bidder unopened, and the bidder may not bid upon the public contract unless it is re-advertised and re-let upon the re-advertisement. So the statute says pre-opening, there's no discretion. This is what happens. Post-opening, there are reasons why the municipality may want to correct rather than withdraw, and there are reasons why the legislature would want to give the municipality that discretion. And I can give you a couple of illustrations.
But there would be reasons why the municipality might want to permit a new bid to be submitted, too.
Correct, but for whatever reason, the legislature said no. And I quite frankly don't know the reason why the legislature said no, but in that sentence, that language has been there since the statute's inception.
Once you're representing CAPE.
Yes, sir.
Are you really trying to get $100,000 for CAPE, or are you trying to interpret this statute for the ages?
Who's paying you? Is that what you're saying? The ages are CAPE?
I have a number of contractor clients, and you've invited us back here, Your Honor, in order to answer questions which I interpreted as meaning you have a pretty good sense on what the statute means, but how does it work in the real world, and how are municipalities supposed to implement this? And so I came here, I think we have to discuss these issues of what the statute means, because Ms. Gibson and I have very different views of them. But I think it is also, from my perspective, perhaps more important to discuss how does this work in the real world, how is it implemented, what are the standards, what flexibility does a municipality have, what rights do the contractors have, and how can they be enforced? So, you know, plainly I represent CAPE in this proceeding, and I'm very mindful of CAPE's, you know, pecuniary interests in this. But, you know, as an officer of the court and with the invitation from you, I think this does allow for a broader inquiry into how are municipalities supposed to get their arms around this and implement this statute.
And it seems to me that some of the answers should be simplicity and speed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it should be a rather simple, as simple as you can make in things in a complex world. And it should move rapidly because my understanding is that once the bids are in and once they're opened, you move rapidly because times change and none of the bids may be good anymore, right?
Your Honor,
yes. Not good.
Yes.
Right. All right. So what is a simple way of proceeding? And we're only talking about after the bid is open, this bidder says, whoops, mistake. Right? Does CAPE want to get out? CAPE does not want to continue in this bidding, right?
CAPE asked to either correct or allow withdrawal and CAPE left that option up to DOT.
Okay. And DOT here says, and that's one fight, whether you can or cannot correct.
Correct.
Okay. And DOT says no correction. Is that right?
It says no correction, and if you withdraw, you forfeit.
Okay.
There's right. No opportunity for any relief.
Well, as I understand it, you got two problems after no correction. One, you have to look at the bond language itself, right? It's to when there's a forfeiture of the bond.
I disagree with that, Your
okay.
Honor. And I disagree with that for several reasons.
All right.
First of all, and I think Ms. Gibson correctly alluded to this, we ought not interpret the statute based on peculiar language in a particular bond.
Yeah,
secondly, the state actually dictates language that it wants in a bond, and municipalities have that authority, and this is primarily a municipal statute, DOA. It's dealt with elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But not all municipalities do that. So I think we should be reluctant to be guided by what the bond says when the municipality doesn't set its terms. And the third reason is that the security may not be in the form of a bond. It could be proof of financial responsibility. It could be an escrow account. It could be a letter of credit. There are options that are available to municipalities and contractors.
All right. Well, suppose that we're not going to allow a correction, just for the moment. No correction. Can't correct before bid is open. You can't correct afterwards. Seems to have some symmetry, right? Didn't make sense before. Doesn't make sense now. It's symmetrical.
It is indeed symmetrical.
Okay. So we got that. Now, CAPE says, I am not negligent in reading the specs or the contract. I mean, let's just say that. Okay?
Yes.
What are CAPE's rights? And we're always talking about this $100,000, right? We're talking about the $100,000.
Yes, you're right.
Okay. So CAPE says, read everything terrific, no problem. What are CAPE's remedies?
CAPE's first responsibility is to provide notice.
Okay.
And the underlying facts demonstrating that it is was not careless in reading the plans okay. and specifications or conforming to the statute.
It does that.
It does that. Then the agency or municipality has to make a decision. yes, we're going to allow you to withdraw if that's the only remedy available, or no, we're not going to allow you to withdraw. And if the answer is no, we're not going to allow you to withdraw, then I see the remedy as being the same as in any other kind of bid dispute, and that is you bring a declaratory injunction action in circuit court. And as with any other bid issue on any other project, the circuit court is going to address that. Or,
back to Justice Bradley. Circuit court's going to address it, and is that de novo or erroneous exercise? You would say erroneous exercise. If I
would say if it is based on the factual issues, yes, it's an erroneous exercise of discretion. If it is based on a legal interpretation that we don't have any authority to grant relief, then I think the judges scrutinize that as an issue of law.
Well, what's this case going to decide? We're up to this declaratory judgment. What do you want this court to say?
I want this court to say several things. First of all, to reinforce the Overdahl three-sequence nature of this statute, that the first two sentences are before opening, the next sentence is after opening but before award, and the third one you get to if there's actually been a forfeiture triggered. Secondly, there is no dispute that if that is the standard, CAPE has satisfied that test on summary judgment.
Which test?
The no clear and satisfactory evidence that the mistake was not caused by a careless act or omission on CAPE's part in examining the plans and specifications and conforming with the provisions of this section.
All right.
And I may say as an aside that there was substantial evidence presented in the summary judgment motions. There had been depositions. That deposition evidence was presented to the court. There were letters that had gone back and forth, some of which are in the appendix to our brief, that were presented to the court. Mr. Cape and a Mr. Schuster, who was involved in the mechanics of, you know, typing in the bid, testified at length as to exactly what they did and exactly the level of redundant scrutiny that Mr. Cape gave this bid after it was all completed, and they just missed it because it was a sub-bidder number that on its face appeared all right.
Okay.
So there was,
You up to where it wasn't careless or act or omission in reading the specs. Now you've moved away from that.
Correct, because there is a second component in that third sentence.
That's right.
And that is also in conforming with the provisions of this section. And the section 66.0901 has other components in it. For example, as indicated in the briefs, there has to be a sworn statement under subparagraph 7. The bidder has to provide information relating to its financial ability to perform under subsection 2. The bidder has to show that it is classified to perform the particular type of work under subsection 6.
But, counsel, the mistake here didn't involve a plan, examining the plan or specs.
Correct.
And it doesn't seem that it involved the conforming with the provisions of this section that you're listing off as
correct.
The provisions of your section. So is the focus of the act here outside of the statutes? There was no lack of, for want of a better phrase, exercising ordinary care with regard to the examination of the plans or specifications. There was no lack or want of exercising ordinary care with regard to conforming to the provisions of this section. So how big is the scope?
It's actually, in this section, it's a fairly narrow inquiry. And the inquiry is limited to whether the contractor was, careless or failed to exercise ordinary care on those two specific areas. And if the answer is no, it wasn't careless and didn't exercise ordinary care, then it is entitled to a remedy. And the question of what remedies are available, we've discussed and briefed. So I would read this section as saying that the only relevant inquiry on the question of whether you get some remedy or not are, did you fail to exercise ordinary care in examining the plans and specifications, and did you fail to exercise ordinary care in conforming with these other sections of the statute? If the answer is no, then you get relief.
But, counsel, the only relief that's currently available is rescission, right? There really isn't anything else that's available today. I assume the project's long since finished.
For CAPE's purpose, yeah, it wouldn't matter, because if they had corrected, they would no longer have been the lowest bid. And if the next lowest bidder had then said, well, we're backing out, then it would have been relevant.
I see what you're saying.
But looking forward to what municipalities are going to be doing in the future, mm-hmm, I think it is very relevant, Justice Rogan said.
But then the municipality has a discretion about which remedy they choose, correct?
That's the way we read it. And, you know, the power system case says that if the legislature is silent on a remedy, it doesn't preclude that remedy. It gives the municipality discretion. And, in fact, the DOT's brief says, well, there's nothing in this section that allows us to settle disputes, but we believe we have that discretion because there's nothing in the statute that says otherwise. But our discretion is only limited to withdrawal, not correction, for reasons that escape me and aren't really explained.
But Mr. Cinderbrand, if I could, much of the discussion today has gone on paragraph 5 of the statute.
Yes.
I just want to go for just a moment to make sure I understand it, to paragraph 7.
Yes.
As part of the proposal, the bidder also shall submit a list of the subcontractors to subcontractors the bidder proposes to contract with and the class of work to be performed by each. In order to qualify for inclusion in the bidder's list, a subcontractor shall first submit a bid in writing to the general contractor at least 48 hours prior to the time of bid closing. The list may not be added to or altered without the written consent of the municipality. A proposal of the bidder is not invalid if any subcontractor and the class of work to be performed by the subcontractor has been omitted from a proposal. The omission shall be considered inadvertent, or the bidder will perform the work personally. Why doesn't that apply?
Because this is not a situation where sub-bidder work was omitted.
I thought the problem was with the subcontractor, wasn't it?
It was with a sub-bidder who gave one number and then changed it at the last minute. So there was a number in the DOT uses a line item bid process. Not all municipalities do, which is why this section is here. But there was a sub-bid number provided.
But if you can't alter the subcontractor bids, maybe I'm missing something. I fail to see why this subsection would not kick in. Once you submit it, you can't change it. Right? It's been submitted, it's been open. You can't change it without the consent of the municipality.
If there is an omitted number, correct?
That's only the last sentence. Look at the sentence before that. The list may not be added to or altered. I think that's the sentence that Justice Butler was looking at.
You're correct on that.
So if you can't alter it without the consent of the municipality, even if you read sub 5, the third sentence, as giving the municipality the option, if the municipality doesn't invoke that option, then it kicks you down to the fourth sentence, if they exercise forfeiture, right?
No. If the municipality doesn't allow you to alter or amend, then the only remedy that's left is withdrawal. This does not address the question of whether you have some right to relief because of an error. It only goes to what the remedy is.
Chief, if I may, one question. If a bid is re-let, what's is there a normal cost or time associated with that? In other words, what comes to my mind is this. Look, maybe a $100,000 bond is to take care of the time and expense, and since there's time passing, the materials go up and delay in the project, and so what's the, is there a norm with regard to reletting of bids in terms of expense and time?
I would say no, there is not a norm, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why this security as a form of liquidated relief is acceptable. It would be difficult to attach actual damages on a breach of someone who, for no valid reason, just says, I'm not going to perform the work. And that is what the bid security addresses. The costs and complications are going to depend on how big is the project, how large an area does it cover, how many qualified bidders are there to do this kind of work, what are the notice provisions within the particular municipal ordinance structure. It's not going to be uniform across the board, Your Honor.
No, it would certainly depend. If there's only one bidder, it would make a big difference as to how they would handle it. It would seem to be with the municipality if there was only one bidder. And went on the bench, I used to represent, this is up in the rural areas, but sometimes you'd only have one bidder on a project and they would have to make a decision based on whether they would accept or reject that bid.
Yes, Your Honor, and that we feel is one of the reasons why it serves the public interest to allow, give the municipality discretion to allow correction in addition to withdrawal. There's always the next project, and you have to be sensitive to who's going to bid on it if we are harsh to our bidders. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cinderbrand. Ms. Gibson.
I just have one comment on the amount of the bond in this case, which is that it needs to be tied to the amount of the project to give the bidders some incentive to remain in the project. This bid was really gigantic. It was $16.3 million, and the bid bond was actually like 0.6% of that amount. So this is a much bigger bond than you'd see in a typical case because the bid was so enormous. And if we're dealing with a little project up north that's where the whole project is a couple hundred thousand, obviously the bid bond will be a lot smaller.
I didn't say it was a little project.
No. No, it isn't necessarily little.
I apologize.
I'm just kidding.
This statute is not just for relief of the bidder, even when we get to 6609015. It's to balance the protection of the public with relief for the bidder. And a reasonable care standard best achieves that balance. The fundamental purpose of 6609.01 is to establish qualifications for bidders. And in fact, in 1933, when the original act was passed, it says a statute to establish the qualifications for bidders. A qualified bidder is one that has certified that it has carefully prepared the bid. So if a bidder has made a material mistake in its bid, it must notify the municipality and provide reassurance that it remains a qualified bidder. One comment I wanted to make in Mr. Cinderbrand's presentation is that his authority for this three-part standard, other than the three sentences, which he cited several times, was Turtle Lake. But if you look at Turtle Lake, Turtle Lake is clear that the carelessness neglect standard applies regardless of whether the contract has been awarded yet or not. We urge the Court again not to apply the three-part standard advocated by CAPE in this case. I still have not heard of any jurisdiction that applies one standard pre-award and another standard 5 minutes later when the contract, public works contract has been awarded. Also, we found no jurisdiction that requires the bidder only to have looked at the plans and specifications and nothing else. And if you'll require, if you remember back to our discussion on this last year, we talked about cases where the bidder makes errors that we would see as very negligent and very material to the project, but they weren't from looking at the plans and specifications. Maybe they were from failing to investigate labor conditions at the site or the flow of the river where they're going to build the bridge or the zoning issues that surround that project. Those are all mistakes we would not want the bidder to have release from to the extent they were negligent, and yet they wouldn't be covered by a plans and specifications test. Further, the plans and specifications test, as Mr. Cinderbrand has described it, creates an internal inconsistency in the statute. And we see that most directly when we take the example of a bidder who has made a mistake but is denied relief properly under CAPE standard. And that's the case you have to look at where you really see the clash happening. So the public authority says, okay, now I'm supposed to just see whether they looked at the plans and specifications carefully. Oh, they didn't look at the plans and specifications carefully, so they won't be allowed to withdraw. I'm going to go ahead and impose the forfeiture. Now, the bidder goes to court and says, court, I want relief from this. Now, you would expect that this would be some kind of judicial review and they'd apply the same standard that the public authority had applied, which would be, again, this plans and specifications test. But when we read the fourth sentence of the statute, it plainly applies now. When the notice of mistake has caused a forfeiture, the bidder may obtain relief only if the error is free from negligence. There's no way to reconcile those two, CAPE's theory, with the fourth sentence in that hypothetical. The reasonable care standard balances the protection and needs of the public with respect for the bidder. It is not draconian. It is perfectly reasonable for the bidder, who is guaranteed a bid, to be held to reasonable care. And I note that the reasonable care standard best protects the public both in terms of fraud and carelessness, because we're concerned about both in public bidding. We're not just worried that the bidder has another gig down the road or wants to take part in the project in some other way, because we might say, oh, good faith is enough, or looking at the plans and specifications, that's enough for that. But we have to look at carefulness, too, in order to ensure that we achieve the best possible work at the lowest possible cost for the public.
Council, when a municipality is exercising its discretion or is deciding whether or not to allow withdrawal, are they acting as a quasi-judicial entity, and if so, what are the implications of that? This is a 10-point toss-up question.
I don't think they're acting in a quasi-judicial capacity.
And why or why not, if you're able to respond to that?
Because they're participating in the process not as an adjudicator, that sits outside the process and determines, you know, on a set of law and a set of facts what's the best effect, but they're participating in the process as a party, as a contracting party.
So in municipal immunity statutes, do you have to be a judge or a administrative law judge or something like that to qualify?
In order to do...
Does the executive branch ever engage in judicial or quasi-judicial activities?
Sure. Sometimes.
When?
Well, just as an example, when DNR, which is part of the executive branch, denies a permit to someone, that would be acting in a judicial capacity. But their DNR isn't part of the process. The person seeking a permit comes to DNR and says, I'd like a permit, and then there's an opportunity for opposition and input from members of the community.
All right. Your red light is on, and I want to thank both counsel for a very interesting argument, and that completes case AP 002817, Cape versus McCauley. Thank you very much.